one. What we're interested in here is not to have any extremely realistic model for evolution of black holes as the universe goes, because we know that most of the physics involved in this process comes from baryon physics and things that are apart from general relativity. Here, what we're interested in is the implications that doing a GR treatment have to give us insight on accretion problems and the evolution of black holes through cosmological history. So what's the motivation? Then we're looking for exact solutions of Einstein equations that have black holes in the presence of self-gravitating matter. So we're looking not really at a back reaction problem. We're looking at the exact solutions. So in any place where self-gravitating matter actually makes a difference. So if we're looking for like late history, where it's too scattered to have any measurable differences, then this doesn't really apply. So this could be an interesting problem to analyze the early universe, for example, or black holes in voids, or anywhere where the presence of matter actually makes a difference to the overall black hole metric. So here we have mostly two competing effects. So it's the fact of we have gravitationally bound objects in the expanding universe. Now, so this coupling between these two effects makes a huge difference on causal structure of the metric, as we're going to see. And for us to analyze accretion through Einstein's equations, so this is a different problem than just looking at Newtonian physics or cross-section or absorption cross-section of a black hole, like Bondi accretion, for example. And this allows us to generalize with all kinds of matter that we see fit once we know what the general relativistic background is. And finally, another motivation that we have is field theory. So how can we analyze the evolution of black holes from a field theoretical point of view? So what if the thing that's being accreted by the black hole is not just some kind of matter that we don't know how to define better, but is actually field? So which has many applications, for example, in modified gravity. If you change gauges, you can describe the modification of gravity as a scalar field, for example. So there are consistency analyses that we can do on this problem. And there's a lot of information that we can get from the equations of motion coming from the field and from the metric itself. Right, so I'll start with a quick overview of classic accretion, of Bondi accretion, and our motivations behind this study. Then I'll do a quick recap of McVitie metric, which is the metric that we're going to use as a base for our analysis here. Those of you who were here for Michele's talk a few weeks ago, this is just going to be a recap, so you can just sleep through this session. And finally, we're going to go through dynamic accretion and analyze the whole problem. Right, so Bondi accretion deals mostly with spherically symmetric models, actually exclusively spherically symmetric models, where we have a homogeneous distribution of particles at spatial infinity. The black hole has a capture, or black hole, or the star, or whatever compact object that you have, that has a capture cross-section that depends on the last circular orbit, Schwarzschild radius if it's a black hole, for example. So if you have non-relativistic particles like dust, this is the cross-section. If we have radiation, for example, you can calculate this is the cross-section. And then from these two, you can, or from any generalization you want, you can calculate the evolution of black hole mass with time depending on the density at infinity. So this is the classical picture. Now, can we do anything better than this? So, for example, can we look at a covariant description of this effect? So, for example, if we take a look at the energy momentum tensor at infinity, can we say anything about its local behavior close to the black hole? So take, for example, the four momentum inside some volume V. So the energy momentum tensor projected in the flow. We can then calculate the momentum transfer from the box surface during some lapse of proper time. And if we make the box a Schwarzschild black hole, for example, then we can figure out that the variation of mass of the black hole proportional to the area of the event horizon times this four momentum projected in the flow. So we have a hint that the variation of mass will depend on, in a spherically symmetric model, on the off-diagonal components of the energy momentum tensor, which generalizes nicely the original Bondi accretion formulation. So pictorically, this is what we have, right? So we have a black hole, and the variation of mass inside this volume will be proportional to this world volume here of the flow of the energy momentum tensor over the surface that is orthogonal to this area here. Okay, can we do anything with that? Yes. So if we take the energy momentum tensor and we couple that equation to the conservation, you can put all these effects together, coupling like Hawking evaporation, then you take the accretion of radiation, the accretion of dark energy, all generalizing that original Bondi accretion that we had. So we figure out that the black hole mass will depend on the densities at any given times, because if we know the cosmological evolutions of these quantities at infinity, then we know how the black hole mass is going to evolve according to that equation. So for example, if we have accretion of dark matter and a cosmological constant, for example, component in a lambda CDM background, then we can integrate this directly with Friedman's equation, for example. Right? So this is the picture that we have, more or less. So this, sorry.
I guess if it's a cosmological constant, it wouldn't have accretion because bump goes back to
zero. No, but it changes the evolution of the density with time. So it will change the dependency. So it will add this term here that wouldn't be present if there were no cosmological constant. So the change you can see here. So this is Schwarzschild de Sitter metric, so only cosmological constant, so no accretion. The black line is just the dark matter there and the same density with the same initial mass with a cosmological constant component there. So you see it changes the time dependency, even though it doesn't actively accrete. Okay, so it's a nice toy model for us to toy with, but it's nothing more than that, because we know that Bondi-like test fluid accretion is unrealistic if we look at spherically symmetric models. Because, well, for many reasons. For example, M diverges if the dark matter density or the background density is too high. We also know that Bondi accretion is too inefficient for it to be any effect that we can consider for, say, primordial black hole accretion or structure formation. And it also, of course, doesn't reproduce observed black hole masses that we see in seeds for supermassive black holes, for example. Right? We know that in this kind of scale, baryon physics is way more important, because the energy loss, because of the self-interaction, makes the accretion more efficient. But this leads to complicated accretion disk physics that is besides the point of looking at this from a general relativistic point of view, right? It also does not explain initial conditions, which is a whole different problem. So can we gain insight if we try to simplify the fluid, but if we look at the most exact description we can possibly find using general relativity alone? And the answer is yes. So The simplest model that we can look at is the McVitie metric. Now, what is that? It's a very simple metric that describes central inhomogeneity with a mass m in an expanding universe with scale factor a, right? So this metric here, this is in anisotropic coordinates. So if we choose some constant scale factor, this will reduce to the Schwarzschild metric. And if we choose a zero mass, then this reduces to the Friedman metric. So this is a nice candidate to describe a black hole in some cosmological history, right? This is also the unique solution of Einstein's equations that satisfies spherical symmetry, the fact that the source is a perfect fluid, the shear free of the flow, the fact that for large radii, this is asymptotically Friedman metric, basically, and the fact that there is a singularity at the center. OK, so good. Is this a black hole? Well, yes, but there are caveats to that. So let's look at the scale, at the causal structure of this metric, right? So first of all, there is a past space-like singularity at this value of the scale factor. So it's not A equals 0. So it's not the Friedman Big Bang that we're used to. So this is a different kind of singularity. And the event horizon is only defined if the Hubble factor goes to a constant as time goes to infinity, a constant larger than zero. So the fluid has the source for this metric, right? It has a homogeneous density, which is the same as in the Friedman metric. So the expansion is homogeneous, and the extrinsic curvature is constant on a comoving foliation. So there's also a nice, this is also a nice metric for theories like Rojava-Lifshitz that have constant mean curvature foliations, or another theory that we're going to see shortly. And the pressure of this source is inhomogeneous, right? So it depends on the Hubble, on the Friedman part, plus some inhomogeneous part here that depends on the cosmological history and the mass, right? Right. So this implies that this fluid is not necessarily doesn't have a barotropic equation of state, for example. So it's a strange fluid. Now, what can we say about the causal structure of the metric now? Right. We know that there is a past singularity. So what is that? So if we go to area radius coordinates and we choose the branch that maps the radius from the past singularity to infinity. So this is a quadratic branching, right? So there are two branches defined there. On one of them, the old radius maps from 0 to the singularity. So it's once, so at 0 we are at another space-like singularity. So this coincides with A equals 0. So it's like the Friedman Big Bang. So we're between two space-like singularities. So it's not interesting. The second branch is more interesting because it goes from the past to some actual infinity. So we're going to use this one. And we can rewrite, using this coordinate, we can rewrite the MacVitie coordinates in area radius, canonical coordinates. And it becomes fairly simple with this definition. Right. Let's look at the apparent horizon. So they're defined as the locus of zero expansion of null radial geodesics. So if we take the null radial curves, and we say that they have zero expansion, then this is the solution, and they coincide, and the solution is this, right? So, which looks suspiciously like the Schwarzschild-De-Sitter event horizon, except that this now is a time-dependent quantity here, right? Right. So we know that from the same reasoning we do on the Schwarzschild-De-Sitter metric, there are only solutions if H is between this interval here. We have two horizons, a cosmological one and an inner horizon. And if the Hubble factor goes to Hubble constant for infinite time, these apparent horizons become the Schwarzschild-De-Sitter event horizons that we use too.
So just so I understand this correctly. So are you saying the expansion of both outgoing and incoming null geodesics at the surface or
no? Sorry.
So you can an apparent horizon is going to define the expansion?
Yes.
Yes.
So the outgoing and ingoing are they're codified by this plus and minus signs here. Now, so if you look at this equation now, the definition of big R being this one in this patch, this goes from 0 to 1, right? So it's always positive. And H is also positive. So the outgoing geodesics don't have a solution. So this is never 0 for outgoing geodesics. This is only 0 for ingoing geodesics. So there are apparent horizons, but they are anti-trapping surfaces. They're not trapping surfaces. So there is, yeah. So it's, yeah, it's an anti-trapping horizon.
That sounds to me like it's not an apparent
horizon. Well, it's an anti-trapping surface. So. Capital R equals 0 is the singularity. So the Riemann, the Ricci scalar diverges. Yeah, little r equals 2m. In this point here, the Ricci scalar diverges.
Right, yeah.
So it's a singularity. So
yeah,
you can't.
Would have been what you would have associated with the event horizon of the black hole.
Yes, if the Hubble, if H equals 0,
yeah.
Yeah, yes, if H equals 0, then that's the Schwarzschild event horizon. Right? Mm-hmm. So the divergent part is proportional to H. So if there's no H, then then everything's fine over there. Oh. Okay. Okay, so this is what it looks like. We have the solution to the node geodesics having zero expansion, the ingoing geodesics having zero expansion, is are these curves here. So the blue curve maps into what's going to become the inner event horizon in the structure of the De Sitter metric. And the red curve is the cosmological, so the De Sitter cosmological horizon. Okay, so. In this metric, yes. Yes, they're both ingoing.
I guess I'm really confused by this discussion. So in between the blue and red lines, you have both ingoing and outgoing non-geodesics.
Yeah, well, these dotted lines here are the no radio curves, okay. Right? So in between the horizons, these are the ingoing ones. So the ingoings have decreasing radius, right? And outside of the horizons, the ingoing have increasing radius. So that's what I mean by, yeah. So in here is like a normal region, say, so where the ingoings are going inward and the outgoing are going outward. So everywhere else, they both have increasing radius.
Does that mean that the blue region below the blue and red line is inside you, right?
This region between these two is
below
here.
Here and the other, and below the red line.
Yeah, okay. So this is, so, okay,
this
so
is
this.
The usual horizon. What about the red line? Where's the area inside the horizon?
The red line. The area inside the horizon is here.
No, I think it depends on what you mean by inside.
Okay,
so the radius goes from 2m, which is the singularity, right?
Uh-huh.
To infinity here.
Okay, I see.
So, yeah.
Below the line, the red blue line, universe is expanding so fast that nothing can shrink.
Yeah. Everywhere, yeah, outside of here.
It's
so.
Just the cosmological expansion pushes everything.
Yeah, exactly. So in here, you can have a time-like curve can have constant radius, but outside you can't. Okay, so this is what we figure out now. So the inner horizon is an anti-trapping surface, and so is the outer horizon. But this is not what we would expect from a black hole, right? We would expect the apparent horizon of the black hole to be a trapping surface, or something that you can't escape. So what does this mean, right? There's another feature that the singular surface r equals 2m lies to the past of all events, which we can also see in the figure here. So all the geodesics can be integrated back to some pair of points in here. And this is a feature that will allow us to draw the Penrose diagrams of the metric, right? Right. So if you go close to the singularity, then you figure out that everything is expanding when you start from it. So and the coordinate time grows from the singularity onwards. So you can integrate everything back. And map it to a point, to a pair of points in the some event. You can map to a pair of points in the singularity. Right. So, if for time infinity the Hubble factor goes to some constant larger than zero, then the inner horizon that I denote with R infinity is traversable in finite proper time. So this means that. If a geodesic or some time-like curve can reach the inner horizon as coordinate time goes to infinity, but in a finite proper time. So this characterizes a black hole, right? Or at least a geodesically incomplete metric, right? So at the Schwarzschild De Sitter limit, so when h goes to a constant, we actually have a black hole. So it's not that the space-time is geodesically complete and we actually go into an infinity. It's something else. Okay. But if the Hubble constant goes to zero at time infinity, then there is a huge discussion about whether this is a black hole or not. Because some of the curvature scalars become singular at the surface. So even though you can still reach it at a finite proper time, the black hole interpretation is somewhat fuzzy. in this limit. Okay, so let's draw the Penrose diagram of the metric. So as I said, we can take any event in the spacetime here, and then we map using null geodesics to the singularity. This is line here, right? And then we can do the same thing to the horizons. So there is a space like infinity here for radial infinity. This area here is like the normal region, so the area between the horizons that we had before. And this surface here is the limit for time going to infinity of the inner horizon. So this is what I mean by it being reachable in a finite proper time. So if some geodesic reaches this thing, it'll be able to traverse it because everything is fine over there. Right? So we need some sort of completion on the other side. So for example, we can choose the Schwarzschild-Sitter patch between the horizon and r equals 0. So this is where r equals 0 in this choice that we make to cover the manifold.
Sorry, I'm confused. Just a minute. You just said that black line was the inner. I'm getting completely mixed up with what you mean by inner, outer, and...
Yeah, so, okay, so the thing...
I've got it that the blue must be the blue that you've drawn in one. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
But then, so why do you label that? So scribe plus is normally future null infinity, right? It looks sort of space-like, yeah?
It is space-like, yeah. May have used the wrong character here.
So what's the solid black line then?
This one?
Yes.
This is R infinity. So this is the limit of the inner horizon for as time goes to infinity. So it's the limit of this blue curve here. So it turns up. So the blue curve, so this is the blue curve as when time equals infinity.
But I mean, this is a space-time diagram, so you cannot turn the time with it.
No, this is a causal diagram. This is a causal diagram.
This is a causal diagram. Yeah. But my point is you cannot say that if I change the time, it changes. The whole history is in here. So, but I guess why you're saying that if Hubble had this asymptotic value, then the blue curve would be the black curve. So that's
yes, yes, yes. The blue curve will be the black curve at the instant when the Hubble factor becomes a constant, so at time infinity. Yeah, this is an asymptotic limit, right?
And so now the thing is, the blue line and red line are not evolving in time.
Yeah,
so they
evolve.
No, they are evolving. They are evolving. What do you mean not evolving in time?
Well, you defined them previously by putting the previous picture had some null geodesics, plotted, and the blue and the red. Asymptotically on your diagram looked like they were the sort of delineators between things that went out, the ingoing non-geodesics that went in or went out. But now, and so that looks like something that's fixed.
Yeah, so
I don't understand.
Okay, so if we go back to the figure, okay, so my point is, okay, so take a look at all the ingoing geodesics in this patch here. So they are all going inwards. And they accumulate on this surface at infinity. So that's what I mean. So since everybody here, every ingoing geodesic accumulates on this surface, so it is in the causal future of all these ingoing curves here to end up in this surface. So that's why it's put here, because it's on the future of every ingoing radial null.
Then what is R minus
and R plus for finite time are these guys here that are anti-trapping. But they accumulate on R minus for time infinity. They never reach R minus again because it's anti-trapping.
But how they, I'm sorry, but you did have an equation for them, I remember that.
Yes.
Is this obvious to everyone?
Okay, I guess we can discuss this. They are exactly the same curves, yes. Now, we have taken infinity and we've pushed it back to this point here. At the time coordinate infinity. But we know that they reach the surface, I mean, they reach R minus in finite proper time. So if we take if we take this equation here, not necessarily equals zero, right? If we take the ingoing geodesic equation and integrate it until R minus in terms of the proper time, then the proper time converges. So it takes a finite proper time for any ingoing geodesic to reach R minus. But they will only do so as coordinate time infinity.
But that's just a first order ordinary differential equation. So R plus or R minus are solutions of time and therefore would be a fixed trajectory on the causal diagram. So are you saying therefore that it's the initial conditions for the solving of that differential equation that are giving you the different curves for R plus and R minus?
Yes and no. So the thing is, okay, so if the initial condition has to be between the two horizons, but this is not the geodesic equation. This is the equation for any null ray. So the geodesic equation will also give you the dependence of these guys with respect to proper time.
I meant that equation, the one that's telling you about the effects, defining R plus and R minus, right?
Yes,
so,
yes.
Or rather R minus.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so you can take some initial condition. Yes, so yes, you can take some initial condition, then integrate it, integrate this curve, not equal zero anymore. So just integrate the curve. And as time goes to infinity, they will accumulate on R minus. At the value of R minus for time infinity. Right? Now, if you take the actual geodesic equation and you calculate how much proper time is going to take for that to happen, then it's a finite amount. I'm sorry, everybody is very confused.
Can I ask the black line is R infinity, is that right? Or
the black line is R infinity, yeah.
So it looks like you just drew it as the path of time like infinity, and so you're just saying that, right, that's like the causal, it's like the boundary of the causal path of time like infinity. So
exactly.
It looks like you're just saying that, I mean, isn't that a definition of an event horizon?
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
So you're just saying that everything gets to the event horizon and the event horizon.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. So yeah, so precisely that. So since everybody's going to accumulate that and they're going to do so in a finite proper time, then this surface here is an event horizon. Right. Okay. So this is just an illustration of what I said before. Like, so constant radius is time-like inside and space-like outside, so you can't stay static in this patch of the space-time. Okay, so okay, so we can do all kinds of crazy operations in this. So we can try to fully complete the space-time. So we can put the full Schwarzschild-DeSitter patch in here. So you can see that there is a black hole, there's a white hole coming, and this is besides the point. Another interesting thing about the McVitie metric is the causal structure. So this way to draw the Penrose diagram is not unique. So it depends on cosmological history too. So the behavior of the horizon as it goes to infinity will depend on this set here. So this set is the initial conditions of pairs of points from the singularity, which you integrate into the future to see how this, to see the ones that reach this this line here in a finite time. So if it's non-compact, like I drew before, then everybody crosses the apparent horizon before reaching the normal area of the space-time. If it's compact, then there are curves that start from the singularity that do not cross the inner horizon before reaching time infinity. So you reach the event horizon from outside, not from the inside. So what do I mean? So this is the picture of a compact set of initial conditions. So the apparent horizon is going to go only to like half of the, this is already very confusing, so let me explain it differently. So the black line is still R equals 2m, it's still R infinity, right? And whether you cross it from here means reaching it from above. So in that graph that I drew before, you're reaching it from above. So you cross, you enter the normal region, and then you accumulate from above on the event horizon. And on this area here, you never cross it. and you accumulate from below, which would mean that somebody that starts some initial condition that starts here will find the outside of the Schwarzschild-De-Sitter black hole after the patch. So this is fundamentally different from the picture that we had before. So you can actually come out of the McVitie metric into a normal area, for example. So we can find this more or less exactly. So we can determine how it depends on the cosmological history. So we can bind the speed with which the geodesics accumulate on the horizon using these functions. And if for example, so this one binds it from below, and this one bounds it from above. So if this guy diverges, then the set diverges, and everybody crosses the event horizon. If this guy converges, then there are curves that don't. So it'll depend ultimately on how fast we get to a Schwarzschild-De-Sitter metric. So how fast the Hubble factor becomes the Hubble constant, right? So let's take, again, the same example. Dark matter and cosmological constant. So we know exactly how the Hubble factor behaves in this case. And the convergence will depend on the sign of that term in the integral. Which we can also define in terms of a one-dimensional parameter eta that will just give us so the sign of this guy will just give us how fast the convergence happens. So we know our infinity in the Schwarzschild-De-Sitter metric, right? And we know that lambda has to be between these two values exactly because we need two horizons to exist in the first place. So there's this nice way to summarize this. So for the product of the black hole mass and the future asymptotic value of the Hubble constant, if it's smaller than approximately this value here, then we have the first case. So then everybody reaches the horizon from above in the McVitie metric. If it's larger than this value here, then we know that not all sets of initial conditions will reach the event horizon from above. Some of them will do it from below, and they will populate the normal area of the Schwarzschild-De-Sitter metric that we patch on the other side of the event horizon. All right, this is all very interesting. So this finally, even though it sounds more complicated than it should be, but this more or less solves the problem of what is the McVitie metric. Is it a black hole? Is it a black hole, white hole? Is it a naked singularity? So this more or less answers the question, and we can now go on to look at the source, right? The McVitie metric, which was a very surprising thing, it's a solution of a scalar field with a modified kinetic term, minimally coupled to GR, and which many of you have heard about, the Kaskuthan field. So if we take this action, there is already one piece of evidence that makes us quite suspicious. It's the fact that it has a constant mean curvature on homogeneous surfaces. If we put this thing and couple the Einstein equations and the equations of motion, they are consistent with the McVitie metric. So we can even find out the potential, which is the same as the Kaskuthan on the Friedmann metric. Moreover, if we take this action, we also learn that metrics with uniform expansion and shear free flow are unique to this type of field. Okay, so this is not enough to make the McVitie metric the unique solution, but can we ask the question the other way around? Given the McVitie metric, is the Kaskuthan the unique action that gives the McVitie metric? The answer is yes. So let's start from some generic K essence. And we write down the Einstein's equations in the McVitie metric. So these are the equations that we come up with. And they have a unique solution that is exactly the Kaskuthan. So we just figure out that the Kaskuthan is the McVitie metric if we want to use a scalar field as a source for it, then the unique answer is it is the Cascutum. That is the next session. Yes. So, okay, so how can we take the McAfee metric that we just understood, kind of, and perturb it a little bit? So our original motivation was to look at accretion, right? So let's look at accretion. So the first thing that we can shoot at is looking at the generalized McAfee metric that was proposed by Valery Faraoni and Henri Jacques, which is just taking the original metric in isotropic coordinates and take the mass explicitly time dependent. Right? So if we take the single non-commoving perfect fluid, the source, as we did before, we immediately come to a problem that is the fact that there is the McAfee metric and the generalized McAfee metric are extremely symmetric. So they both have the spatial Ricci isotropy, which is the fact that all these components are the same. So it doesn't have any anisotropic stresses in the commoving flow. So this feature allows us either a commoving fluid, so there can't be no radial velocity, or if we abandon this and choose some four velocity, some non-zero radial component in the velocity, we are required to choose Schwarzschild Sitter. Okay, so one perfect fluid is out of the picture. So how about two? We can choose, say, two perfect fluids. So one dark energy, for example, and one dust component. And we are still confronted by the spatial Ricci isotropy, which becomes this equation here. So the radial component of one of them and the other fluid have to be related by this equation. This is positive, so one of these guys has to be negative. So we have a violation of the weak energy condition. So we have a phantom equation of state here that needs to be satisfied. But this is not the worst problem that we have. I mean, the big problem is actually this is not an inequality. This is an equality. So it's very fine tuned. So we can do better than this. So no perfect fluid survives, but I mean, they do, but they have to be severely constrained by that symmetry. So how about we generalize our fluid? Let's go imperfect fluids. So some heat conductivity, bulk and shear viscosities. Well, first of all, McVitie class is shear free, so we don't need to worry about this guy. Second of all, the bulk viscosity can be reabsorbed into the pressure, and we can turn it on later if we want to look at a viscous point of view. So we're left with heat conductivity. If we look at the simplest hydrodynamical model that we can think about, Landau-Eckert, for example, there is a relationship between the fluid temperature and the heat flow. So there is a homogeneous component of some temperature that you can define in equilibrium, plus the heat flow component here that will show up as an off-diagonal component in the energy momentum tensor. Right. Now, that's the answer. So an imperfect fluid will give us McVitie, generalized McVitie, as an exact solution. Now, we have these two arbitrary functions. We can write the density. So there will be an inhomogeneous component proportional to the variation of mass here. Think of it as this expansion scalar. And the energy flow inside the black hole, so which we, right at the beginning, I related to the T01 component, right, is exactly this m dot, this component here that's proportional to m dot in some temperature that we can define. Nice. So where the pressure was, the density was homogeneous, it becomes inhomogeneous. The pressure is also changed, but these graphs are not important. I'll just skip through them because I don't have a lot of time. Okay, now we have, this is hard to see, but the singular surface is here. Okay, so this is transposed with respect to the other graph. I apologize for that. So this is time and this is radius now. So above is actually above, it's not to the right like before. So now we have the horizon, the inner horizon is expanding. I mean, the value of its radius is growing, unlike the other part. So this changes the causal structure a little bit. We can think of a toy model for the mass accretion.
Can you explain, so what is minus plus? They have a minus region and plus region?
It's, okay, so the plus region is where the ingoing geodesics are expanding, and the minus region is where they are contracting. So it's basically the same regions that we had before. The only difference is this guy is not going to some lower constant here anymore. So it's increasing because the mass increases, for example.
This is rotated by 90 degrees.
Yeah, it's transposed. Yeah. I couldn't convert this graph decently. So we can think of an example to look at this that doesn't incur too many problems in the causal structure. For example, we choose some constant value of mass before some initial time, another constant value for mass after some final time, and an intermediate accreting phase. And let's see how this happens. So we can choose.
Can you choose times where m dot is always positive, or even while this
field? Yeah, we chose only accreting in black holes. So yeah, that's only positive. So if Hubble factor goes only to a constant, the same thing we did before. So for example, we can try this shape for it just to see what happens. So that's what happens in the horizon. So the green lines here and here correspond to the constant mass MACVD, which is the graph we had before. The red lines here are the outer horizons for constant mass MACVD. And the purple here is the outer horizon in an accreting black hole, and the blue line is the inner horizon of an accreting black hole. So, and these are the ingoing geodesics. So, as before, they all accumulate down here, but in this area, so afterwards they will actually be equal to this area at a finite time, at an infinite coordinate time, but at a finite proper time. But here, because this guy is increasing in radius. I'm just zooming in that area. So they actually cross it. So things go inside the horizon and then come out of it when the accretion is over. What this implies for the causal structure is something that we still have to know. Right. Can we do the same thing we did with ordinary MACVD? Can we put an action and use it as a source? Yes. So let's take the most general action we can think about, the Horn-Desky action. We know already that the additional terms in the action must look like heat flow and nothing else, right? So let's add new terms piecewise. So let's take the kinetic gravity braiding term. So we have the original k essence that we had here plus some function proportional, some function times box phi. So we can rewrite this Lagrangian in a nicer way that for us to go to the energy momentum tensor, right? So this one is one possibility, but we could look at the full Horn-Desky action, for example, and turn on everybody. So this is the full action, right? So with all the components. Now this component here and this component here have non-vanishing anisotropic stress, so they violate the spatial Ricci isotropy of the MACVD metric. So at least, as far as we're concerned with MACVD, we don't need to worry about these terms. If we want to look at some more general metric with shear in the flow and everything, then we should worry about those. But for MACVD, we can be comfortable with just these two. All right, so what's the energy momentum tensor? Now, taking that action and calculating it, this is what we come up with. So there is some term that is proportional to that looks like a density here, something that looks like pressure, and something that looks like heat flow. So you can rewrite these quantities like that, which is nice because everything that is new here is proportional to g. So it's the new function that we added, right? So the inhomogeneity in the density, the difference in pressure, and the whole of the heat flow are turned on because of the generalization, the higher order term. We can plug this into the Einstein's equations now. So this is the TR Einstein equation. This is the TT Einstein equation. We can solve the TR Einstein equation exactly. And then we come up with this form for G. So the new function would be proportional to some function of the field plus the log of the kinetic term plus some other function that is not important, can be reabsorbed. And there is a nice relationship between the field and the mass given by this form of the function here. So we haven't found an explicit form for this function, but we know how it relates to the mass. Right? So if m dot is 0, then we're back to the Coscoton. OK, so we can take the solution, insert it back into the time equation. And then what we find is this other equation. So you can see the Coscoton term here, plus there is some new guys that come because of g. Right? And we can solve it. So the solution for the k essence part is the Coscoton plus this modification here. Now, how about the relationship between these unknown functions here and the metric? So we know that in the Coscoton, they're proportional to h dot and h squared. What happens here? So here, we can do the same trick and plug this solution into the last Einstein equation that we have. That's the radial Einstein equation, right? And this is what we find, that the potential term will be modified by the fact that the mass is changing in time. So big M, I wrote as m dot over m. Right? So this is the modification that is introduced here. And the term that multiplies square root of x will depend on the quantities like this. Right. So what does this say? Right. This tells us, OK, so did we find a solution? Not really, right? Because what we found is the explicit dependency with the kinetic term and the relation between these functions and the metric quantities. Now, can we find some function of phi, plug it into these values here for f1, f2, and g, and find the solution? Right. But before that, there's also another equation that we didn't look at. It's the equation of motion of the field, right? That's the only thing that makes it different from the previous analysis. Right? So before we were doing like the poor man's way of solving Einstein's equation. Right? So we take some metric and we try to make sense of the fluid it generates. Now here is something slightly better than this. We're looking at a field, right? So there's an equation of motion that this field has to satisfy, which is this one. This is the equation of motion for the scalar field. If we plug our definitions for the k-essence term, for the kinetic gravity gradient term, into this solution, what we find is it gives us 0 equals 0. So the equation of motion is identically satisfied by these functions here. So what does this mean? This means that we have a self-consistent system. So nice. So once we determine these functions and we plug them into the action, we can find our evolution. You can find some McVitie black hole with a time-dependent mass and a cosmological history that will be given by the values that we choose for these functions here. And also very interesting, this reduces to the original McVitie if g equals 0. So if m goes back to 0, then we have the same equations that we did before. But this is nice.
You're also saying the remaining Einstein equations are identically satisfied?
There are only three independent Einstein's equations. So it's the TT, the TR, and the RR. So each of them gives one of these constraints here. Because we, yes, but remember that the McVitie metric has Ricci isotropy. So GRR, theta theta, and phi phi are equal.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
So that's the thing that hugely simplifies. So it was a problem before because it constrained the system too much. But here's a good thing because that's already granted by the radial equation. OK. Now, what else can we say about these coefficients, right? So we have these three coefficients. And in this equation, in these equations here, they are written in terms of metric functions, so they depend on t. But OK, all right, we have a homogeneous field, so it's only a function of t. But it would be nice to write it as a function of the field, right? Because that's how they appear in the action. It's not cool to have something that is supposed to depend on phi, depending on phi dot explicitly in the action. That'll change everything, right? So we can rewrite them by playing with them. We can rewrite them like this. So we can write g naught as this function, so some derivative of the mass of phi that we can, by the implicit function theorem, we can just go from phi to t here. And so this gives us the dependence of the mass with respect to the value of the field. So this is only a function of phi. We can rewrite F2 in terms of F1 and G0, like that. So again, only functions of phi. And at the last, we will have something that will relate phi dot and the functions, F1 and G0, with respect to H, which is explicitly dependent on time. So what we have is, so we can fully determine the system, we need two functions. Either, so any two of G0, F1, and F2, so we fully determine the action. And explicitly, we need phi of t that we can't integrate directly using these equations. Now, compare it with the Cascuton case. The Cascuton case, we have one function. The other can be reabsorbed into the field, right? If we give this one function and the time dependence of the field, which we can't determine just by looking at the equations, right? We also determine the metric. So it's basically, okay, so it's not the same thing, but it looks like the same. I mean, we have two coefficients that we need to determine and the evolution of the field. So this suggests that this new field with this KGB term looks like a high order Cascuton. We're not sure of that yet, but this is the nice punchline. We have some parasitic field that gives an accreting black hole depending on how this function behaves. All right, so what's next? Well, we still have to figure out the causal structure of this generalization of the McFeeding metric. So we made a lot of there are a lot of things on which the previous analysis depends. For example, the singularity has to be space-like. Now, if the mass accretes fast enough, this is not guaranteed here anymore. So generalized McFeeding is a whole other beast that we have to look at from the beginning again. What are the thermodynamics of this new field? Like, can we define an entropy? So can we do a better job at the temperature, like with a nice hydrodynamic model? How do the laws of black hole thermodynamics behave on this thing? We still have to look at this. Can we interpret this as an actual fluid accretion by reabsorbing the heat flow into the rest frame of the fluid? Are we actually, we still have to fully be certain of this, but is this new field a high order Cascuton? Is this a field that doesn't have any degrees of freedom, just like the Cascuton doesn't? And in the future, we can look at generalizations of the metric side, right? So we can look at the full class of shear free metrics that the Cascuton, for example, is a solution of. And we can even go further and look at and abandon the shear free and look at the anisotropic stress that comes from the even higher orders of L. But this is piecewise. So so basically this is it. This is what we've been doing so far. And what started as a bottom-up approach to understanding black hole accretion stayed in the bottom because we're finding so many interesting causal structure related things and so much entangled things about the field that this become an important problem, I mean an interesting problem to analyze even from the formal point of view. So there's too many things for us to look at. Thank you.
Any questions?
You have a story, so what you're drawing is by traditional definitions of naked singularity, and unlike some of them, I'm not sure where. And some of these things, you have a story about, okay, in black hole stories, it's in a high collapse, or if it was the Big Bang, you know, it was something like inflation, so like, at least might not notice it. This looks like it's kind of a hit you in the face kind of naked singularity. Do you have a story to deal with that?
Well, it's the thing is where's the mouse here? The singularity r equals 2m there, it is. Right, this singularity here, it's a Big Bang singularity, right? So it's not really, it's a past singularity. So I'm not sure it's a naked singularity.
Yeah, well, if I can get signals from it, that's what a naked singularity.
Yeah,
is.
But so is the Big Bang, right?
Right, but like I said, there's usually at least some story you can tell yourself that at least okay, at this era, it's reasonable to neglect that effect, and this
yeah, well
this to me doesn't look like that at this time.
Yeah, well,
this is
the same problems as the Schwarzschild metric, right? So this is an eternal black hole, so something that has been around ever since the Big Bang, all the way to here. So I don't know how reliable this, I mean, astrophysically speaking, how reliable this initial part here is.
Well, I mean, you know, the usual resolution to that, right? The usual story is, of course, that they weren't eternal; they're formed by collapse, and then that goes away.
Yeah, exactly. So this past part here is as reliable as the Schwarzschild. Is the best in the Schwarzschild metric. So we have. I'm not sure if I answered. Probably not.
Yes. Usually, when you solve Einstein's equation, you impose a matter model, like either a vacuum or a specific equation of state for a fluid,
mm-hmm.
and then you solve for the metric components.
Yes.
But in this approach, you're writing down a metric,
yes.
and then you're going the opposite way, and
yeah.
you're saying what matter do we get? And you get this like position dependent equation of state. How physically realistic is that?
Well, it's an incompressible fluid, right? So
its equation of state depends on position.
Well, it's not really an equation of state. I mean, we haven't been able to write the pressure as a function of density. Yeah, as you say, it's position dependent. So it's okay, so you can write a certain coordinate system in which this coordinate dependence vanishes. I don't really know what that one is.
Yeah, but I mean, in this room, the equation of a state depends on position.
It frequently depends on many, many other parameters than just density. Barytropic equations of state are
very special subcase. Yeah.
Okay, but I mean, how is it constraining the metric at all? If you're just writing down metrics and then analyzing.
Well, that's why looking at just a fluid, it's called the poor man's way of solving Einstein's equation, because you're just trying to make sense of what the fluid is. But if you put a field in there, then the dependence with if the field is homogeneous, then the dependence with position comes from the metric. So you can blame the field and say, okay, so it's this dependence with position comes from the action, not from the
So there is a trivial part and there is an untrivial part. So usually when you know what matter is, you have the action, and you solving the Einstein equation is an untrivial part. That if you're lucky, you can do it. If you're not lucky, you have to use the computer. But the non-trivial part here you're assuming the metric, but there's no guarantee that there's a scalar field action that consistent that satisfies the Einstein equation for that metric. The non-trivial part here is that yes, indeed there is a scalar field action.
Yeah. So you don't have to assume the coordinate dependence from the beginning. It will show up from the equations. That's the fundamental difference.
But did you check if TMU satisfies the energy condition?
Well, they do as long as the pressure, density, and heat flow satisfy certain inequalities. The thing is, already because we want this to be Schwarzschild decision in the end, we know that it's going to fail. Right? So we know that some of the energy conditions are not going to be satisfied in there. So sure, we can. So the point is, if we choose, so in the end, it will depend on the values of these. It'll depend on the values of the coefficients. So the values of the coefficients will relate. Blah 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 blah. So depending on these functions and the coefficients, we can see if they will satisfy the energy conditions or not. But again, this will depend on. I mean, this is not necessarily generally true for whatever coefficients we choose to put here. But then again, I'm not sure how important it is. Everywhere, like in the future, we know that this is not going to be satisfied. So, as far as like, for example, if we want in the accreting phase, we want this solution to be stable. So the fact that the fields do satisfy the energy condition is a good hint, but it's not everything.
That's usually how you distinguish physical solutions from non-physical. So that's why I'm asking.
Yeah. Well. It can satisfy the energy conditions if we choose suitable functions here. And now we have to see what kind of evolution they give us. So we already know that the metric, that there will be some McVD metric that will satisfy the energy conditions here. Now we have to make sense of what kind of evolution that gives us.
Okay, well, before we thank Daniel again, I think, as usual, we will be going for dinner in the bistro with Daniel, and you're welcome to join, probably about 6:15 or so. So, let's thank Daniel again.